This morning we'll read select passages from Genesis 37. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept that matter in mind. So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him far off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against to kill him. They said to one another, "Look, the dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." Then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see all of you here. I want to add to the thoughts that were presented by Larry at the outset of the worship hour this morning concerning the special service that we have next Sunday morning. There's not going to really be anything different about the service itself, except that we are making a concentrated effort to invite outsiders to come. We think this is a lesson that will be very appropriate and meaningful to people out in the world, especially those who are struggling with hardship and difficulties in their life. And we want to encourage all of you to do your part in inviting people to come to this service. We have a ton of postcards back there. In fact, probably at some point during this week, I'll spend a little time going through the neighborhoods here, dropping these off. Anything that you can do on your part to share this information about this service through this coming week will be deeply appreciated. And then, of course, we have the start of a new series in our small group studies on Sunday night, starting next Sunday evening. And we encourage everyone to take full advantage of that, and likewise to use this as an opportunity to invite people that we know to come and share in what we hope will be a very profitable study. Before we get into the lesson of the hour, very quickly, as we customarily do, I'm going to give just a quick overview of the sermons that we have coming up over the next few weeks. We already talked about November 11th, next Sunday. The following Sunday, we'll spend some time talking about churches and the care of orphans, what the Bible says about that subject. 2 weeks from today, our son-in-law, Chris Huntley, is going to be here, and he will be speaking for us. And then 4 weeks from today, we're going to pick up with our Genesis study, and that will be the follow-on to the lesson that we're going to look at today. And that lesson, we're going to look at the price of forgiveness, what it took for Joseph to truly forgive his brothers. And the purpose of forgiveness is such an essential element in human relationships even today, and hopefully this will be a valuable study. However, today we are looking at the topic of the fruits of envy. The fruits of envy. And this is based on the story found in Genesis chapter 37 of how Joseph's brothers so horribly mistreated him and why they mistreated him. I spared you reading the entire chapter. It would have been very helpful to have seen the entire context, but hopefully the abbreviated version that Steve read in your hearing a moment ago is sufficient to get across the general gist of what happened on this occasion. In our last lesson, we were looking at the dysfunctional relationship that existed among Jacob and his wives. We saw all of the catfighting, the bickering, the conflict, the resentment that existed among these people, and they just could not get along with one another. And that was Jacob and his wives. Well, now, in this lesson, we're going to turn our attention to the children that were raised in that kind of dysfunctional environment. And we'll find out that, as kids always do, they learned from what they saw. In fact, they took it to the next level. The level of hostility and hatred and conflict that they saw in their parents, they just fueled it further. And they became murderously bitter toward one of their brothers in particular, and that, of course, was Joseph. The key word that we want to notice here is the word that's found in verse 11. Did you notice that? It says that Joseph's brothers envied him. And that one word pretty well summarizes everything that we want to know about what happened here in Genesis 37. This is a horrible episode in the chosen family of God. And how something this terrible could happen among people who should have been models of decorum and fairness and gentleness and all the other good things that we think people of God ought to be. This family was as far away from that as they could be. And this verse identifies envy as really the root cause of everything that fell apart in this family. The dictionary defines the word envy as a feeling of discontented or resentful longing aroused by someone else's possessions or qualities. Somebody else has something, and it need not be a tangible material thing. It can be a quality. It can be some advantage that they have that I don't have. And inside of me, I allow this resentment, this discontent, this feeling of this is not right to begin to well up inside of me. And that is what, in our English language, we call envy. The English essayist Samuel Johnson wrote an interesting little essay on the subject of envy in the year 1751. And in that, he, as part of his definition of envy, made this statement concerning envy and its desperation. He says, quote, "It pursues a hateful end by despicable means and desires not so much its own happiness as another's misery." And that's really what makes envy so dangerous. It corrupts the person who has the envy, for sure. We'll see that in our lesson this morning. But it also seeks the downfall or the destruction of the object of envy. It's trying to bring misery into the life of another person. And as we'll see in our lesson this morning, as you study the brothers of Joseph, it's obvious that envy is at the root of so much of what is plaguing humanity today. And for the most part, we fail to recognize it for the powerful destructive force it is. So what we're going to do this morning is look at three things that we can draw from this text. Number one, what envy brings into our lives. Number two, we're going to look at why envy is such a destructive force in our lives. And then finally, we're going to look at how to minimize the ravages of envy in human affairs. So let's plunge in and talk first about what brings envy into our lives. What is the avenue or the occasion by which envy comes into our lives? Now, in this story of Joseph and his brothers, there are two factors that really stand out, jump out at us. First one especially. And that is the preferential treatment that the brothers saw was being conferred upon their little brother Joseph. And here we have to point an accusing finger at poor old Jacob. Now we saw this in our last lesson, that Jacob played favorites among his wives. He clearly preferred Rachel over the older sister, the older wife, Leah. And it created all kinds of problems between the women and between Jacob and his wives. And it should not surprise us, therefore, to see that same pattern began to unfold in the way that Jacob treats his children. He takes his favorite wife's son, Joseph, and puts him on a pedestal. And he openly confers blessings and advantages upon him that he does not confer upon his older brothers. In fact, the text tells us that he made this wonderful coat of many colors. Now, to you and I, that just seems like kind of a fashion statement, but back then, it was more than that. It was the sort of thing that the patriarch of a family would bestow upon one of his sons to confer princely status on him. This is the one upon whom my blessing rests. And throughout the rest of this family's existence, this is my boy. And this was the message that Jacob openly was telegraphing to his other children. And naturally, they hated him for that. Look at verse 3. Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. He made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. But there is another element that seems to play a role here, and that is a presumed or perceived superiority on the part of Joseph. When you look at his dreams, now clearly there's no question the dreams came from God. It was a message from God that someday, somewhere down the road, that Jacob's brothers were indeed going to bow down before him. But now remember, Joseph is a 17-year-old kid. He does not have the wisdom of years to recognize when it's appropriate to share something and when it's not. And he just blurts out, "Hey, I had this dream. In fact, I had two of them." We only read one a moment ago, but he had two of these dreams. The mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. And others, two dreams that say that Joseph's brothers are going to fall down before him and worship him. Now, what would be the purpose in Joseph sharing that information? This is something personal between him and God, but no, Joseph shares it with his brothers. Some commentators take the position, and I'm not sure I completely agree with this, but they say that Joseph really was being a little proud and arrogant here, just a little youthful cockiness showing itself here and saying, "Hey guys, guess what? Someday you're going to bow down before me because I had a dream. I had two dreams." They say this is what is going to happen. Well, I don't know that I'd go so far as to pin all of this upon Joseph. But suffice it to say, that's how the brothers interpreted it. That's what they saw in Joseph giving these dreams that he had had. And so both of these elements play a role in the events as they began to unfold over the course of this chapter. Now, there's one other element, however, that we want to bring into this story that is not explicitly stated anywhere in the story, but the rest of the Bible clearly helps us to understand what's going on behind the curtains, something that we can't see. If you go to the New Testament, there are a couple of passages that clearly connect envy with what we'll call selfishness or self-centeredness. Look in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 26, where Paul writes, "Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another." Notice the connection between conceit and envy. We envy people when we feel like ourselves, our worth, our value is somehow being attacked or diminished by somebody else. And so we envy the person who we think is threatening us in some way. That's conceit, Paul says. That's in play. Look also in James chapter 3 and verse 14. "If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your heart..." Again, the connection between the envy in our heart and the self-seeking in our heart. Selfish ambition, some translations say.
It's all about me. It's what makes me look good and feel good and be good. And if that is threatened, I envy the object that is threatening it. That person has an advantage over me that I resent because it makes me look bad. Anytime you see envy at work in human relations, recognize that somewhere in the background, and usually it's deep down in a heart or hearts that we cannot peer into and actually see, but somewhere in there, God's word says, there's some selfishness going on. People are more concerned about themselves and about their interests and their desires and their goals and their ambitions than they are the other person. And when that they feel or perceive that that's being attacked or threatened in some way, envy is a response. They feel this deep resentment against the person that seems to have some advantage against them. So that, in a nutshell, is what brings envy into our lives. Let's turn our attention now to why envy is so destructive. Now, we tend to think today, when we use the word envy, if we were to catalog all the great sins of the heart that the Bible talks about and that we recognize in human relations, envy is somewhere way down the list. We prefer to put other sins up there like hatred and anger and greed and covetousness and lust. I mean, these are the bad ones. Envy is somewhere down below. In fact, we almost, in some cases, we use the word envy rather flippantly. Oh, I envy you this new car that you have. And we'll say it with a smile, and we'll laugh about it and go on, and no harm done. That's a terrible mistake. Envy ought to be up at the top. It is precisely because it seems to be so innocuous on the surface. It seems to be such a rather insignificant little thing, a minor character flaw, that we don't pay much attention to it. But the story of Joseph and what his brothers did to him in this chapter tells us there is so much more going on with envy and what it can do. And this story tells us why envy is so destructive. Let's look at what envy led to here. We've already noted in verse 4 that they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. And why was that? Well, because their father loved him more than he loved them. There's envy at work there. The hatred grew out of the envy. Yeah, hatred's a bad thing. That's why it's high on our list. But don't we recognize oftentimes the envy is what brought on the hatred. It's what allowed the anger and the hate and the hatred and the hostility to start welling up on the inside because we see somebody else has an advantage over us that we can't do anything about. Look also in verse 5. He had this dream. He told it to his brothers. They hated him even more. In verse 8, the father, Jacob, speaks to Joseph, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Three times in this text, we're told, they hated Joseph. And it all came out of envy. Anytime you find people ratcheting up the level of hatred toward each other, know that somewhere in the background, on one or possibly both sides, envy is busy at work. That's where this hatred is coming from. And of course, hatred quite often usually leads to violence. Now, in this case, they determined early on that they had to, the best course of action for them was just eliminate this kid. Just remove him, rub him out. Some of them wanted to kill him. And some cooler heads prevailed and said, no, he's family, we can't do that. But here come some Midianite traitors, let's get rid of him. So they sell him into slavery, and he's carried off into Egypt. Now, back in those days, being sold into slavery in circumstances like this was, for all practical purposes, a death sentence. Someone like Joseph, a young, healthy young man, probably put to work in a salt mine or somewhere under brutal conditions. He'd last a few years and then he's gone. buzzards eat his body, and that's the end of him. And that's pretty much what the brothers were more than willing to let happen to their younger brother. They weren't willing quite to go so far as to kill him with their own hands, but we'll let somebody else to do the work, do the dirty work, and we get 20 shekels of silver for our trouble. Now, we look at that and we think, this is awful. This is horrible. Do we see anything any worse today as we look around us in our society, the way people treat one another? What is God's Word telling us here? That so much of the violence that people perpetrate upon one another can be traced back to, in one way or another, envy. On either the part of one party or the other, there's envy at work. And when that resentment boils up to a level of hatred, then it's just a simple step to some form of violence. Physically, verbally mistreating somebody in a way that God does not want his creatures to treat each other. But there's another reason why envy is so destructive that we see in this story. How are the brothers going to explain to Daddy what happened to his favorite boy? Now, we did not take the time to read the rest of this chapter, but you probably are familiar with the story already. And that is, they took Joseph's coat of many colors, they dipped it in the blood of a goat, and they brought it to Jacob and said, "Dad, we found this coat. Does this belong to your son?" Expecting, of course, that Daddy is going to connect the dots himself. And as they planned, that's exactly what happened. Jacob, look at what Jacob said. He tore his clothes. No, he recognized and said, "It is," in verse 33, "it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him without doubt. Joseph is torn to pieces. He tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, 'I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning.' And thus his father wept for him." He was weeping for a lie. And who fed him that lie? The brothers. Deceit. Mark it well, envy always seeks to disguise itself. We will never, ever, ever come out and tell somebody, "I hate you because I envy you. Because I see something in your life, some advantage, some quality, some advantage that you have over me, and I resent that, and I hate you for that." We'll never tell anybody that. We'll cover it up. We'll disguise it. We'll pretend there's something else going on here. There's some other reason why our relationship is not what it used to be. But we'll never come out and attribute it to what it is. Envy. Envy always leads to deceit. We will lie. We will cover up. We will obfuscate. We will do whatever we can to make sure that people don't know what's really going on in the deepest, darkest depths of our heart. And this is not the only time the Bible talks about these elements being in play in human relations. Look at how many times in the New Testament we find envy being connected with all of these inhospitable, inhumane kinds of treatment. In Acts 17, in verse 5, as Paul and Silas are teaching the gospel in the city of Thessalonica, and they're converting quite a few of the Gentiles, we're told that the Jews of that city, becoming envious, gathered together a mob and set the city in an uproar. Mob violence now can be attributed to envy. Romans chapter 1, verse 29, Paul, in describing the descent of the Gentiles who had rejected the knowledge of God, and he describes their descent into the deepest levels of depravity. And among the things that he attributes to them was they were full of envy, murder, strife, deceit. There's all the elements right there. And envy leads the list. Are we beginning to get a clue here? 1 Corinthians 3, verse 3. Here Paul is talking to a group of God's people, a church in the city of Corinth, where there are envy, strife, and divisions among you. Are you not carnal? Paul says, this is the way people out in the world behave. You are the people of God. How on earth can you allow these kind of carnal attitudes to seep in to your number, into your hearts, and create this kind of chaos? 1 Timothy 6 and verse 4, speaking again of Christians who began to get involved in all these silly disputes and arguments and wranglings, from which he says, come, guess what? Envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions. And I like Paul's use of the expression evil suspicions here. You know what an evil suspicion is? I don't have any evidence, direct, hard evidence, that you've done something wrong or you have taken advantage of me in some way, but I have a pretty good suspicion about it. Have you ever seen that? I'm not sure. I don't have any ironclad proof of it, but I have a strong suspicion. That's what Paul calls evil suspicions, and it's right in here with the same in the same category with envy, strife, and reviling. Philippians 1 and verse 15, even preachers, Paul says, some preach Christ from envy and strife. Brother so-and-so over here holds so many gospel meetings a year, and he's paid so much more, works in a much bigger church. Well, he must be doing something wrong. He must be doing something. He's preaching, he's tickling people's ears or something. I mean, he could not, if he's really preaching the truth of God, he could not be that successful. And so I'm going to have to tear him down. I'm going to take him down. And you look at so many preacher fusses, and it's just as blatant as it can be. That envy and strife is working behind the scenes. Satan has found a way to get even men of God to turn on each other. And it's envy that is at the root of all of that. And we see it now in these brothers. Here are young men who are the recipients of the great promise to Abraham, that through Abraham and his descendants, this family, a Messiah will come. God will bring a blessing upon all the families of the earth through this family. And now, what has happened to these boys? Envy has turned them into vile, treacherous men who will turn on one of their own. My friends, we need to learn from this. When we allow envy to fester in our hearts, it grows into a cancer that creates a host of problems. And it's not just our problem. It is going to infect everybody around us. You see this at the personal level. You see it in marriages, in friendships, in churches. In every one of these relationships, what do we have? We have different roles and responsibilities. We have different talents, different strengths, different gifts, different contributions. And these relationships thrive or fail depending on how the participants in those relationships manage their differences. Do they appreciate each other's differences? Or do they resent them? Do you see how simple this is? The fact that we're all different is okay. That's the way God made us. It's how we choose to react to those differences, how we view them, especially any advantages that others may have over us. But then take the role of envy at a personal level and multiply it by several million times, and we're looking at the role of envy on a societal level. Let me pose this question to you. Why is our country being ripped apart right now by so much anger and hatred and violence? I'll let you answer that question. Have we ever thought about the role that envy might be playing in this? There is an enormous degree of diversity in our society across classes and across groups, is there not? And how often are we told to celebrate diversity, right? And by the way, I agree with that. We should celebrate diversity in our population. But doesn't that diversity in itself fuel resentment? One group sees another group as having a perceived advantage. There's resentment. And that resentment is going to grow. It's going to manifest itself in some way. And now you've got two groups that are at loggerheads with one another. And define the groups however way you want. But we have people that cannot get along with one another, and it begins to ratchet up to the point that terrible things can happen. What we're looking at is envy on an industrial scale. And mark it well, lawyers and politicians make a living off of it. They benefit from watching people come to blows against one another. It didn't used to be that way in our nation. Several years ago, Bono, if you're familiar with him, he is the lead singer for the rock group U2. He was commenting on the difference between America and his native country of Ireland. And he made this statement, and I quote, "In the United States, you look at the guy that lives in the mansion on the hill and you think, you know, one day, if I work really hard, I could live in that mansion. In Ireland, people look up at the guy in the mansion on the hill and go, one day, I'm going to get that so-and-so. Now, actually, Bono used another word there, but I cleaned it up for this audience. But you get the point. You get the idea. What used to define us as a nation is the fact that we were able to hold envy at bay. We recognized it was an evil, it was bad, it was corrupting, it was destructive. Violence, strife, anger, hatred, we didn't want any of that. And that's not to say we've been perfect along the way, certainly we haven't. But on the whole, and Bono recognized it, historically, we've managed to keep envy out of our relationships with one another. And if we've lost that ability to coexist with one another, what does this story tell us may be the culprit? We've allowed envy to creep into the way that we look at one another, and it is destroying us from the inside out. But that brings us to the third thing that we want to consider, and that is how to minimize the ravages of envy. Now, there are two approaches that we can take based on what we've looked at thus far. Remember, a major contributing factor to what we see in the story of Joseph and his brothers was the extreme, unforgivable favoritism that Jacob was showing toward one of his sons. And so, it'd be easy to say, well, if we could just eliminate inequality, then that would eliminate any possibility of envy, right? Eliminate the inequality, remove all favoritism, all advantages or disadvantages are just removed to the point that everybody is equal, and then there's no occasion for envy, right? In theory, that's the way it sounds. And let me be very clear here, there's no question, and this is a strong biblical statement, that we ought to strive for fairness and justice and equality among ourselves. Isn't this one of the things that made early Christianity so appealing to people? That you had slaves and masters and rich and poor and men and women and people from all different races and ethnic groups and nationalities, all being able to come together and sit down together as brothers and sisters and worship a common God. That's the power of the gospel. And that is one of the great messages from the Bible and God's story of redemption that He's given us, that there ought to be fairness and justice and people treating each other with equality. But can we be realistic here? Absolute equality of every element in our relationship is simply never going to be achieved. And Paul even addresses this in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Remember in that chapter, Paul is talking about the body of Christ consisting of all these different members, right? You've got the foot and the ear and the eye and the toe and the hand, and all these different elements comprise the body. But the key thing is they're all different. They all bring different gifts, different talents, different backgrounds, different experiences into their relationship with one another. And Paul poses the question in that chapter, if they were all one member, if they were all exactly the same, where would the body be? You wouldn't have a body, you'd have a freak. So let's just accept the fact, as Jesus said, the poor you will have with you always. We're never going to achieve a state of what we could call nirvana in this earth, where everybody's going to be exactly the same, exactly equal, and there will be no occasion for envy. A diversity of talents requires a diversity of outcomes, and we're always going to be wrestling with that. So this is not a realistic way of dealing with the envy problem. And one more thing we might notice here before we leave this point. Have you ever thought about this? If my approach to solving the envy problem is to eliminate inequality, then what am I doing? I am making other people responsible for my happiness. Right? If I can get that person down where he needs to be, then I won't feel envy toward him anymore. I'm pinning my happiness on what's going on in his life or what he does or fails to do. Is there anything biblical about that? My happiness is my responsibility, not yours, not anybody else in this world. I need to figure this out. That's biblical. So we need to dismiss this as the solution to the envy problem. And that brings us to the New Testament, in which the cure for envy is spelled out for us very clearly. Look at what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 13, his beautiful soliloquy on love. He says simply, love does not envy. Love does not envy. You see, love places the responsibility for addressing the problem of envy where it belongs, and that's on me. I'm the one with the envy problem, right? Now, I can talk about the man in the mountain on the hill or people who have all these other advantages around me. I can talk about that all day long. They're not the ones with the envy problem. That's me. That's my problem. I'm the one that has to deal with that. And remember that a key component to envy is selfishness. If I love those around me as God wants me to love them, then I'm going to have to confront the self-centeredness, the sense of victimhood that I have allowed to infect my mind, my thinking, my view of other people around me. I am not a victim. I am a child of God. I am a recipient of the love of God, and it is my job as a child of God to repay that to everybody that I encounter in my life. I have no room in my heart for envy anymore because I love people too much to envy them and whatever advantages they may have. It means instead of envy, I'm going to replace that envy with active goodwill toward others, which is what love is. Even those who have more money, more talent, more good fortune than I do in this life, doesn't matter. Because I love other people, instead of resenting them, I have a genuine appreciation for whatever success they might have in their life. Whatever advantage they have over me, I praise God for it. I'm glad God has given them what they have. Because I love them. And their advantages don't bother me. My worth, my value in this life is tied to what God thinks of me and the advantages that He has given me in that relationship. Stop and think about it. Let's go back to our story of Joseph and his brothers. Do you suppose that there could have been a more mature approach that the brothers of Joseph could have taken in dealing with the inequities that plague their family? Now, you don't have to be a Christian follower of God to read this story, and you just turn away with disgust. How immature, how vain these brothers were to treat their little brother in such a crass, crude fashion. This is inexcusable. You know, everybody reads this story and they just shake their heads. These guys were idiots. Are we any better? Look in your own relationships with people around you in which envy is beginning to eat away at the value and the quality of those relationships. Why can't we recognize that more lofty road that was available to them that we see they should have taken? Why can't we recognize that same lofty road in our relationships as spouses, as brethren, as citizens? In every aspect of our lives, we have to root out envy because Satan is going to use it to his full advantage. Anytime he can spot some kind of difference, some kind of inequity, some kind of injustice that we might perceive in the world around us, he's going to turn that into envy with all the fruit that comes with it. And folks, can't we say Satan has been very successful at that? We are no better, oftentimes, than Joseph's brothers. We play the fool just like they did. Many years later, of course, the Son of God came to this earth to fulfill the mission that his father sent him to accomplish. And like Joseph, he was, and even Pilate could see it, he was delivered up by the chief priest because of envy. Matthew 27, verse 18. But have you ever considered the fact that instead of looking at Jesus as the object of envy, which his enemies did envy him, have you ever thought about the possibility of Jesus himself having something to envy about the people around him? That there were things that Jesus could have pointed to, he could have looked at in his life and said, that's not fair. That's not right. This isn't the way things ought to be. And it was personal. It could have been personal to him. Jesus, no doubt, saw the rich and the powerful who lived in their mansions up on the hill. And they were comfortable. Everyone was satisfied. Every need was theirs. While Jesus had no place to lay his head. He lived a life of poverty. Do you think that gave him something to envy? Or think about those who were well-connected, those who were in positions of power and prestige. They were shielded from all the hardships and the persecutions that afflicted the common man in that day. Jesus did not enjoy any of that. He was subjected to all the hardships and the persecutions like everybody else. Do you think he could have envied them for that? Was that fair? And of course, at the very end, what happened? The wicked, the hateful, the brutal conspired to destroy him, and they got away with it. Would that give Jesus something to envy? God, this isn't right. This isn't fair. You can't let them get away with this, God. The same sort of language that we use concerning or about or to one another, fueled by envy, Jesus could have said all of that. Did he have a reason to be resentful for the way he was treated? Well, of course he did. Did he resent? Do you remember one of the words, the last words that Jesus spoke on the cross? As he looked down the very men who had made his life so miserable, what did he say? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He loved them to the end. Folks, this is what envy can do to us. And this is the only way. Jesus has shown us the only way in which envy and all of its evils can be dealt with. Jesus lived a life devoid of envy, and in his death, he offered us a model of how we can rise above the pettiness that consumes the human race. Brethren, let it begin with us. Let our lives show the same kind of love that Jesus had on the cross toward his enemies, and not envy one another. If you're here this morning, you recognize the pain and the chaos that envy has brought into your lives, and that and many other sins that plague us. Jesus Christ died to forgive you of all of that, to offer you a new life, a different life. And if you want that, we'll do all that we can to help you find it. Won't you come as we stand and sing the invitation song?